Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickard. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, a look at the Obama administration's immigration agenda and what it means for 2012. Obama has to walk a fine line between support of the economy and the idea of America as a nation of immigrants that welcome all. We have a couple of guests this hour. Joining us for the first half of the hour, we have Matt Barreto, Associate Professor of Political Science at Washington University and Director of the Washington Institute for the Study of Ethnicity and Race and the Washington Poll. And for the second half of the hour, we'll be joined by Denise Gilman, a Clinical Professor of Law and Co-Director of the Immigration Clinic at the University of Texas School of Law. And we'll go now to our first guest. And of course, I want to give out our call-in numbers, too. We always want to hear from you about immigration and whatever we're discussing. The number 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk@wpr.org. And Matt Barreto, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, sure thing.
Well, in Texas, a little bit back, President Obama gave an important speech about immigration and sort of outlined what he was striving for in that area, tried to highlight his accomplishments. What do you think emerged from that speech?
Well, you know, I think the president for a while has been trying to figure out how to walk that line between securing the border, enforcing the immigration laws, but also dealing with immigrants who are already here. It's a very tricky situation. And I think he tried to walk that line there in the speech in El Paso. And for the first time, we really saw the president come out fairly tough on the Republicans and saying, hey, look, the time for immigration reform is here. For the first 2 years, he had really been not waffling, but he hadn't really taken a tough stance. He had given in and said things like, yes, we still need to secure the border. Yes, we still need to enforce the laws. And I think in that El Paso speech, for the first time, he really laid it out and said, look, the border is secure. We've been enforcing the immigration laws. My executive agency tells me it's working, and it's time to pass immigration reform. So he really sort of threw down the gauntlet and said to the Congress, let's work together to finally try to get some legislation passed.
Do you have a sense about what makes now the right moment? Are there political motivations there for 2012?
Well, you know, I don't think that even the president believes that now is the right moment that immigration reform will pass. So I think that's a very good question in terms of why did he choose this as a time to do it. And I do believe that there are some political implications here. Certainly, the president himself believes that immigration reform should move forward. But with a Republican-controlled Congress, in particular with Mr. Lamar Smith, who would be in charge of the committee, who would bring the legislation forward, it looks extremely unlikely that any immigration reform, comprehensive immigration reform, will pass in the current situation. And so I think a lot of people are questioning why did the president pick this as the time to really go out of his way to highlight this as being on his agenda. And we have to wonder what the 2012 election may have done. And I think the president is trying to do outreach to the Hispanic and Latino population. And now we're going to have to wait and see whether or not there is any action on immigration and what the president continues to say on this matter as the election approaches.
So it could be positioning himself as a Latino-friendly candidate, the sitting president there, who would support the immigration issue for Latinos who are already here. Is that what you think is going on here? Is he trying to curry favor in that voting bloc?
Yeah, I think he absolutely is trying to shore up his credentials for the Latino community. We've been conducting some polling of Latino registered voters for Latino Decisions and Impra Media, which is the largest Spanish language media outlet in the United States. And those polls have found that the president is still fairly popular. He's in the about 70% range in terms of approval. Hmm. However, there's a much lower percent who say that they're going to vote for him in 2012. We find that it's only about 40 to 50% who say, yes, I'm going to vote for the president. And so there's a gap there of about 20 or 30 points of people who say, yeah, I like the president, I approve of him, but I'm not sure I'm going to vote for him yet. And I think those are the things that are a little bit troubling for the Obama administration as they head into reelection mode. And say, how can we shore up some of these supporters, people who supported us in the 2008 campaign, and who may be, you know, scratching their head this time around saying, what have you done on these issues? Of course, in 2008, during the campaign, the president promised, as many presidents do, that immigration reform would be a priority and that he would try to get this done. And of course, healthcare ended up dominating the agenda in the first year and a half. I think he's going back to some of those promises he made in 2008, not just to the Hispanic population, but to many different groups of voters that supported him. And now he's trying to come back and say, look, this is still an issue. We still need to address the issue. And he's trying to navigate that political environment there to see what exactly he can say and promise, you know, without going too far again and perhaps making a promise that he can't follow through on.
So you've got about 40% to 50% of those Latino voters saying they'd vote for him this time. So what do you think the big issues are, as in general, with Latino voters? Are they more concerned about the stinky economy, or are they more concerned about a president who'll be supportive of the immigration issue?
Well, I think both of those are important. The economy is certainly a top issue, I would say, to voters across the country, across different groups. Across different ages, different demographics, the economy is really dominating voters' minds. That was the case in 2010. And I think that will still be the case as we head to 2012, that people are looking for economic security, housing security, and other sort of factors. But for the Latino population, unlike the general population, there's a second issue that is hanging in there right with the economy in terms of equal importance, and that is immigration reform. We know that a huge percentage of Latino voters in this country who will be voting in the 2012 election are immigrants themselves, and a very, very large percentage are the children of immigrants whose parents immigrated to this country. And so it's a very personal and real issue in the Latino community that affects a very, very large number of families. And people are saying, you know, we're watching the news, we're seeing that deportations are increasing, that the number of people being separated from their families who perhaps have children here or who perhaps are married to somebody who's a U.S. citizen, these people are getting rounded up and deported. And we want to know what's happening. Why are these deportations happening? Is it because immigration reform is on the horizon? And so I think he has a lot of questions to answer there. People are wondering, how are we going to continue dealing with immigrant labor, which there is certainly a need for this labor. It's not as though immigrants are literally shoving people out of line for these jobs. These are jobs that tend to go unfilled after these raids and mass deportations have happened. In fact, in many instances, after a small town or an agricultural community is hit by a raid from the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the jobs go unfilled, and in many instances, the employer applies for H-1B visas to bring in more immigrants, guest workers. So it's a very significant issue, and it's a significant issue in the Latino community, I think, and people are talking about it, and people want to know, what is the administration going to do? And I think that's why you've started to see this action, not just the speech in El Paso, but a lot of meetings at the White House, a lot of discussions about immigration reform.
Well, it's an interesting thing because I guess the critique when we talk about economics is that those jobs you were talking about filled by illegal immigrants are somehow undercutting the American economy by providing such cheap labor. So what do you think Obama has said about that? Where do you think he comes down?
Well, you know, it's certainly a tricky situation because there is cheap labor there. Does that help the economy? Does that hurt the economy? You can find reports from economists, you know, that sort of suggest immigration overall has a net positive effect. But in pockets or for individuals, there could be issues where, you know, people are concerned about the economic impacts of immigration. There's no question about those concerns exist. But I think the economy is certainly a larger, more structural issue that needs to be addressed. And to put the blame on immigrants as taking jobs, I think, is short-sighted. And it doesn't mean that that's not happening now and that some people aren't frustrated about the levels of immigration. But certainly that is not the cause of the economic crisis that the United States or other countries are facing today. There's larger structural things that need to be addressed. And immigrants currently are taking a lot of the blame for that. And so that, you know, continues to push back on the Hispanic and Latino population. People see not only a lack of immigration reform, but in many times in our surveys when we ask Latino voters how do they view the current environment, there's a very high percentage who say that, you know, we're currently living in a hostile environment, that there tends to be, from both the media and the general public, an anti-Latino or anti-immigrant sentiment floating around in America today. And so this is a significant concern and something that we don't want, you know, the everyday population of U.S. citizen Hispanics and Latinos feeling as though they're unwelcome in their own country of which they're citizens. And so those are very significant issues and things that, you know, need to be addressed and talked about when we talk about immigration reform and the economy.
Right. There are bigger, I guess, maybe emotional is the wrong word, but societal questions about how we treat immigrants in this country. Of course, you know, if you go back in our nation's history, there, you know, Italians, the Irish, they often felt as though they're, at one point or another, they were the downtrodden immigrant group that nobody respected, and maybe that's what we're moving through now. And how do we deal with that?
Well, I think that's certainly the case. If you look at the history of the United States, there's both the positive and the negative. On the positive side, we have been built through waves of immigration and through immigrant incorporation, that this is a society that has valued immigrant contributions and eventually helped those immigrants incorporate into society. But at the same time, with each wave of immigration, the United States has faced a fairly stiff anti-immigrant sentiment that has popped up to sort of try and protect native-born interests against the interests of immigrants. And so I think we're currently, you know, in the midst of that, with the Latino population in the United States, and that's something that we need to think about is how does the rhetoric that we use that's used on TV or radio or by politicians towards immigrants, how does that affect you know, our society overall? Because these are by and large U.S. citizens that we're talking about here in the Hispanic population, who either have parents who are immigrants or brothers or sisters or aunts or uncles, grandparents, and when this rhetoric is being used that these people are stealing jobs or ruining America, you know, that has a significant effect, and I think that people need to be careful. And I think you saw a lot of that in the 2010 election. This was a very heated election in 2010. You had states like Nevada and Arizona where there was a very strong anti-immigrant sentiment being used as an election issue. With candidates such as Sharon Angle in the U.S. Senate and Jan Brewer, the governor of Arizona, who's known for signing a lot of those immigration laws. So it's a very, very interesting time to be observing Hispanic politics in the United States, but there's also a lot to be concerned about. And I think now the president, bringing back to the president is really trying to walk this line of saying, I understand that people are frustrated about immigration, but at the same time, we do need to move forward incorporating these immigrants into American society, just as we have done for years and years.
Well, as you said, this is not legislation that's going to pass anytime soon. There are bigger fish to fry right now for President Obama and that administration. But on the other hand, you've got Mexico, which seems to be, you know, maybe I'm wrong about this, but from the news reports about the wars with corruption and the drug cartels, it seems to be sort of crumbling from the inside, not able to hold up to that pressure. What happens if Mexico fails in America in terms of immigration?
Well, you know, the main driving force for immigration does tend to be economic and political opportunities in the United States. And so we're currently at a time in which, even as Mexico and other countries around the world are experiencing problems, you know, as the United States recession is here, there's just fewer jobs for immigrants as well. And so I wouldn't look at as much of Mexico as a failed state in the current environment and what implications that will have on migration towards the United States, because we're generally in a time in which I think, you know, folks in Latin America who might be thinking about immigrating to the United States are looking and saying, you know, there's fewer opportunities there right now. The problems in Mexico tend to be, you know, centered around the drug cartels, that the average person isn't experiencing these problems, and that they're going to and from their job and their family without any problem. But certainly in, you know, isolated areas around the border, there has been an increase on the Mexican side in violence, and that is something that is of concern, you know, to the government in Mexico and should be to the United States as well as our bordering country. How will we address that? What support will we give? And certainly any country in the world would like to see stability on any side of its borders, north or south, and not see any sort of spillover. But at this point, I haven't seen any good research that would suggest that that drug situation in Mexico is causing any migration. I mean, people are tending to come here for economic opportunities, and as we said right now, those are a little bit lesser. And so most of the reports, including the one cited by the Obama administration in the El Paso speech, are that the immigration numbers to the United States are down a little bit right now compared to previous years.
Our guest this first half hour is Matt Barreto, Associate Professor of Political Science at Washington University and Director of the Washington Institute for the Study of Ethnicity and Race and the Washington Poll. And we welcome your phone calls and your emails this hour. What do you think about the Obama administration's stance toward immigration? Do you think he's doing the right, striking the right balance between supporting immigrants and also being conscientious about the border and the economy at the same time as concerns immigration? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, and our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 1 o'clock today, join us for Talk of the Nation. Today, join host Neil Conan for a conversation about Saudi Arabia, the U.S., and the U.S., I should say, oil, and the Arab Spring. That's 1 o'clock's Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. Or, sorry, just rather, Talk of the Nation. And we are talking immigration this hour with a pair of guests. The first is Matt Barreto, Associate Professor of Political Science at Washington University. And for the second half hour, Denise Gilman, who is a professor of law at the University of Texas School of Law. And we go to our phone lines right now. We have Victor joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Victor.
Good morning. Good morning to your guests. A couple of comments and observations. One is there really a unity amongst Spanish-speaking Americans? Because I understand you have distinct cultures within Spanish-speaking population. You have the Cuban Americans, predominantly in Florida, who definitely vote Republican, so Obama can't expect a lot of support out of them. You have Puerto Ricans, Mexicans, Ecuadorians, Chileans, a lot of them. Are they really unified as far as immigration support, or do they have their own interests, which I understand that they may do? The second comment is we put a lot of emphasis on the Mexican immigrants, but it just seemed like, what about the other immigrants, the ones from Eastern Europe, from Ukraine, from Bulgaria, the Haitian Americans, the people coming in from China, Taiwan? It just seems like there's a lot of emphasis on the Mexican immigration, but what about the rest of them? Is there going to be any fairness of immigration policy toward them as well?
Great questions. Thank you, Victor. And Matt Barreto?
Yeah, those are great observations. You know, and to the first point, the Latino population in the United States is very diverse, as the caller observed. The Mexican population of Latinos tends to be the largest, as most people are familiar with. About 70%, but there are very, very noticeable differences between, say, Mexicans or Puerto Ricans or Cubans or Dominicans. What we've been finding in the research is that in the last couple of years, and especially in the last year since the Arizona law SB 1070 was passed, we're starting to see that coalescence. While the differences used to exist, that more people are sort of coming to the same outlook on issues of immigration, largely because even though most of the anti-immigrant rhetoric is directed primarily at Mexican immigrants, the media and the politicians who are making these statements, they don't have the ability to discern. And so if you're from Ecuador, or if you're from Colombia, or if you're from Guatemala, you sort of get lumped in together as part of this immigrant population that's coming. And what we found in the research is that in the last couple of years, people are starting to coalesce and share a similar opinion. And I think that's telling. It's showing that that sense of group identity is really increasing in the last years among Latinos, as they felt that Latinos as a group are being attacked as an immigrant population. To the second point, you know, I think that's a really important point that we need to continue the conversation about, that even though the Latino population makes up a majority of immigrants in the United States, it's just only just a bit over 50%, 55% or so. There's a very diverse immigrant population in this country. And when we're talking about immigration reform, that is not something that's only going to benefit Latinos. There's a huge number of Asian immigrants as the next largest group, but also immigrants from Africa and the West Indies and parts of Europe. And so I think that it's incumbent on the media and politicians, as they address the immigration issue, to not keep using examples of Mexican labor or of a raid somewhere in Iowa at a meatpacking plant, but to talk about the diversity of the immigrant population in the United States. That's always been here in this country, and it continues to be the case today. Even though most people associate immigrant with Mexican, you know, it just isn't the case that that's the only immigrants we have. We have a very, very diverse immigrant population, and there are considerable needs across that immigrant population. As any immigration legislation moves forward, it would equally affect all groups of immigrants, even if it has one group in mind. All groups would be eligible for immigration reform and legislation. But I think the point that the caller made is that that needs to be part of the discussion, and we need to talk about that diversity.
Great. Well, thank you, Victor. And Matt, do you have time for one more call before we let you go?
Sure.
Great. Let's take Heidi calling next from Soldiers Grove. Hi, Heidi.
Hi. I am an immigrant myself. I've been here for many years. I came to this country as a legal immigrant. Now, Matt has not once made the distinction between legal and illegal immigrations. I think the big problem in this country is the illegal immigration. There is a legal program in place and has been for years and years, and it seems to me that most journalists do not distinguish. They just talk about immigration. It should. I think there should.
Nope, I think we lost you, Heidi, but thank you for the point. And Matt, I'll let you take that.
Yeah, no, it's a point that comes up very regularly, is talking about why are some immigrants here legally and some immigrants here illegally. And I think that, you know, there's a general frustration there when people hear that word illegal. But we really need to unpack it and say, who are illegal immigrants and why are they here, quote, illegally? And, you know, a huge percentage of those people who are here illegally, as many as 50%, are people who are visa overstayers. That is, they came here legally. They did come with proper credentials, with a work visa, with some sort of documentation. But at some point or another, they didn't fill out a renewal, or they weren't eligible to fill out a renewal, and they already had a family here. And so this image of people coming across the border and sneaking over the fence is actually inaccurate, according to the research, that that a huge percentage of people are visa overstayers. On the second part, on the people who, you know, did come, there is well-documented research that suggests there are employers in the United States, meatpacking plants and agricultural employers, that go directly to Latin America, advertise jobs, and set up the transportation to bring people here and say, hey, look, you can have a job making as much as $18 an hour. We can't fill those jobs with people who are currently living and working in the United States. And so they're going out and they're arranging for the transportation. So the idea that, again, somebody's, you know, sneaking across the border in the middle of the night isn't the typical person who fits this idea of illegal immigrant. In many cases, these are people who were specifically recruited by U.S. employers to come and work in various industries. And so it's a very, very complex picture in terms of how those people came to be in this current status in the United States. And I think the big issue is, now that there are a very large number here, over 10 million. What exactly is the country going to do? Are we going to try to find those people who have children in U.S. schools or who are married to U.S. citizens and make them go back to their home countries? Or are we going to try to figure out a solution that would allow them to continue to work and live here? And it is a very, very complicated issue, to say the least. But a good discussion to be having right now.
Well, Matt Barreto, thank you so much for your time this morning. It's been great to talk with you.
Sure thing. It was my pleasure.
Matt Barreto, our guest this morning, Associate Professor of Political Science at Washington University and Director of the Washington Institute for the Study of Ethnicity and Race and the Washington Poll. And we welcome our next guest this morning, in this hour, Denise Gilman, Clinical Professor of Law and Co-Director of the Immigration Clinic at the University of Texas School of Law. And Denise Gilman, thank you for being on.
Good morning. Thank you.
I know you were hearing the tail end of that conversation there, and I wonder if you could catch us up on some of the latest legal proceedings. I know that there was recently a Supreme Court decision revolving around in-state tuition in California. Could you tell us about that?
That's right. Well, actually, on the in-state tuition in California, what has happened is the United States Supreme Court has decided not to review a decision of the California Supreme Court, which upheld the California law that permits in-state tuition for undocumented students.
And where was that appeal directed? Where is it coming from?
In terms of who brought the litigation, there have been some groups who have contested the legality of state laws which embrace the possibility for undocumented students to study and to contribute to our educational system and then to our economy. And they have, so some groups have challenged the decision of states to allow for in-state tuition for undocumented residents. They brought litigation in California. They brought litigation in Texas because there are about five or six states that have permitted in-state tuition. So that's where it came from. And then, as I say, what happened is the California Supreme Court upheld the state law that allowed for this undocumented student in-state tuition. And then, as sort of a result of that, in other states, including Texas, where I am, the state courts have allowed the in-state tuition laws to remain as well.
How significant a decision was that not to hear an appeal?
It's significant. Now, the Supreme Court, of course, only hears a small percentage of the cases that litigants attempt to bring before the Supreme Court. So it's not unusual that the Supreme Court will decide not to hear a case. But it's still significant in that it allows the California Supreme Court's decision upholding in-state tuition to stand.
And what else is happening in the courts right now as relates to immigration?
Well, there's a lot happening in the courts right now in relation to immigration issues. Of course, the Arizona SB 1070 law, which has become very well known because of the concerns that it will allow for racial profiling by local police who would be investigating immigration status issues. That law has been challenged in the federal courts, both by the federal government of the United States and by individuals who would be affected in organizations such as the ACLU. And at this point, that law has been enjoined by the courts. In other words, it has not gone into effect because the courts have expressed concern that it will likely be deemed unconstitutional in the end. And the Federal Court of Appeals at this point has upheld the injunction against that law. The Supreme Court has not heard that case yet. Now, the Supreme Court did recently hear another matter involving Arizona laws, a prior Arizona law that was much more limited in scope but did touch on immigration. That earlier law provided for revocation of business licenses to employers who were hiring undocumented immigrants, and that law was recently upheld by the United States Supreme Court. It was a very narrow ruling, though. That particular law was was quite carefully crafted and really established only that the Supreme Court, that the Arizona licensing bodies would abide by federal determinations regarding undocumented workers, and only in those cases where the federal government agreed that a worker was undocumented and should not have been employed would licenses for businesses be revoked, much, much narrower than SB 1070 and some of the other legislation that is coming up through the courts.
Well, let's get back to some of our callers. We have full lines right now. First, we'll take Jake, who's waiting to talk from Stevens Point. Hi, Jake. Jake, are you there?
You hear me?
There you go. Go ahead, please.
Oh, hi. Well, I'm sort of curious about, I read about the Real ID Act, and I'm curious how that will affect immigration. And I've also, I read this article or the story, there was this gentleman in Arizona, he's a truck driver, and he stopped at a weigh station, and the police approached him and asked him, you know, what he's doing, or asked him who he was, and they ended up requiring him to produce his birth certificate, and he didn't have it, so they detained him, and then his wife ended up bringing his birth certificate, and they let him lose. He was in Arizona, but he was born in California. I'm just sort of curious, you know, what's going on with all that.
Well, that's exactly the concern, is that as soon as you ask local police to become involved in immigration enforcement in making those determinations as to who will be investigated for immigration status, then it sweeps in all sorts of individuals with perfectly legal immigration status in the United States and even United States citizens. And mostly, of course, who it will sweep in terms of this sort of aggressive inquiry into immigration status and the rest, it will be based largely, of course, on ethnic, racial, language characteristics, because it's very difficult to imagine what else, in fact, police officers would rely on in determining that they believe there's a concern that somebody is undocumented and that they would like to further investigate. Now, what that situation that you described does show is that even under current law, police officers have been and do inquire about immigration status. And for the most part, there is no law that prohibits that. Again, there are some real concerns about when and where and on what justification officers do that. But as a current legal matter, so long as there's not profiling taking place, it is permissible for officers to ask those questions. The difference with laws like SB 1070 is that they actually require law enforcement to engage in those types of inquiries. SB 1070 even exposes individual police officers to litigation, to claims against them, if they fail to inquire into immigration status. And that's one of the things that's most worrisome about the legislation.
Okay, well, thank you for that call, Jake. And we move to Jessica in Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Jessica.
Hi. I just had a question about if they were to take the undocumented workers and issue them all visas, wouldn't it take some of the edge off of our problems with Medicare and Social Security?
Okay, thanks for the question. And Denise?
Well, undocumented immigrants absolutely do not qualify for Medicare. And for that matter, they do not qualify for most social services programs. So that really is a bit of a red herring. It's a bit misleading. There really wouldn't be any pressure taken off of most of our social services programs if undocumented migrants were forced to leave the country. Undocumented migrants do sometimes have to take advantage of emergency services, and those are available. Of course, a hospital cannot turn a person away because they have undocumented status. But most of the research on this shows that migrants in general contribute significantly more to the economy than they receive in terms of benefits because they are so limited in their access to most forms of government benefits. While they are paying at a very minimum, they're certainly paying sales tax and the like. Many are also paying income taxes because they hope that by maintaining a clean record in terms of paying income taxes and the rest, that should it become a possibility for them to regularize their status, they will be in a good position to do so because they will have kept up with their governmental obligations. Similarly, many individuals are paying into Social Security even though they are undocumented. If they are on a formal wage basis, and many are, they are paying into Social Security, although they will never see any of those Social Security benefits coming back out in their favor.
We're talking with Denise Gilman for the rest of this hour, clinical professor of law and co-director of the Immigration Clinic at the University of Texas School of Law. And we're hoping to hear from more of you this hour. How much do you as a voter care about immigration right now, maybe in the lead up to 2012, and how much in general? And what reform are you hoping for in the coming years? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, and our email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 2 o'clock today on Wisconsin Public Radio, join us for Talk of the Nation. After 2, a look at the promise and reality of new advances in the war on cancer. That's 2 o'clock's Talk of the Nation. I'm Veronica Rickert, in this week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, as we talk about the Obama administration's stance on immigration with Denise Gilman, our guest. She is clinical professor of law and co-director of the Immigration Clinic at the University of Texas School of Law. And we'll take our next phone call now. We have Bill joining us from Madison. Hello, Bill.
Hello. The previous guest that really pushed my button that made me inspired me to call, but I think my questions, comments still relevant. I have a close friend who lives in one of the border states of Mexico, and from what she tells me, things are a lot worse than what the previous guest indicated that they were in terms of the violence. In fact, she even says that for all intents and purposes, Mexico, the president of Mexico is no more relevant than the mayor of Mexico City. That essentially the border states are essentially they're no longer controlled by the Mexican government, and I've seen horrific things that happen there to ordinary people, not people who were involved in the drug trafficking trade, but just people who are trying to live their normal daily lives. And if things keep going as they are, a lot of people down there even think that Mexico is going to collapse as a state. It's going to become like Somalia. And we're going to have a huge wave of political refugees, people who are coming to escape the violence. What is the U.S. preparing for in terms of that scenario? I'll take comments off the air.
All right. Thank you, Bill. And Denise, as you guessed, Bill covered a little bit of what our last guest said, but he also said that in general, the violence in Mexico, especially with the drug cartels, was not affecting immigration to this country, that it was all about economics and whether there were opportunities in America for people from Mexico. And what do you think? What is your take on that?
Well, this is a very interesting question. It's a developing area in migration right now. I'm actually inclined to agree, perhaps a little bit more than the previous speaker, with the caller, that the situation in Mexico has become extremely problematic. There are a number of recent reports out on this. The United Nations Working Group on Forced Disappearances just conducted a visit to Mexico and expressed deep concern about the level of violence in the immigration field. We're hearing, of course, about not only, as the caller suggested, extreme violence executed among normal residents of Mexico, small business owners, certainly journalists and human rights workers, but also others who have been caught in the crossfire, including line police officers who have attempted to pursue the rule of law and have suffered severe consequences as a result of that. But in addition to those targets of the violence, we are also, of course, seeing that migrants coming through Mexico from Central and South America suffering very high levels of kidnapping, extortion, and violence, including the murders of several hundred migrants. Mass graves have been discovered just in the last couple of months. So the violence is very real. I do think that it will lead to greater numbers of asylum seekers from Mexico. And here at our immigration clinic at the University of Texas Law School, we're seeing some of that already. We don't have a large number of clients with that sort of background, but we do have some and expect to see more. We're in contact with some of the migrant shelters, for example, in El Paso, and they're seeing much larger numbers than they ever imagined. I spoke to the director of the shelter there in El Paso, who said that he's been doing this work for 20 years or so and was very accustomed to seeing waves of migrants from Central America fleeing the violence, and is very taken aback personally at the idea that now the waves of migrants are coming from 30 minutes away across the bridge. It's really taken him aback. So it's real. What is the government doing to prepare for it? I don't know yet that the United States government has really acknowledged this situation either, in terms of asylum seekers especially. I think the courts are just now getting a handle on what the issues are in these Mexican asylum cases. That's why we as a clinic have agreed to take them on, in the hopes that we might help to sort of begin to set up a framework for analyzing and understanding these claims. It's still all very new. There have been very few successful asylum claims from Mexico, but there have been a few, and I think there will be more. It will not be enough. It never is enough under asylum law for somebody simply to say that the situation is extremely violent in northern Mexico. It will be important to show that an individual is being targeted and based on certain protected characteristics, such as their political opinion, a particular social group, for example, of human rights defenders, or some other protected characteristic.
We talked earlier in the hour about President Obama's shoring up of the border and his assertion that the border is more secure now. And this is why, at least in his speech, he said it was time to pursue immigration reform. Let's do a reality check. How secure do you think the border is?
Well, what I can say for sure, and you may have already discussed this earlier in the program, is that the numbers of deportations are on the rise, if anything. So there certainly is no softening of immigration policy at this point. We're up to almost 300,000 deportations a year, which is a record number. There has, of course, been additional fencing built along the border. My research shows that that is the least effective, perhaps, of any measure to prevent undocumented migration. But it certainly is there. It's not as lengthy offense is often portrayed by the government, but it is there. The numbers are certainly down in terms of undocumented migration. That's according to official governmental statistics, as well as anecdotal observations from individuals along the border and organizations along the border. The research suggests, though, that the reason, the most significant reason the numbers are down is the economy, and I'm guessing that you did discuss that, because it's clear by the government's own statistics that the ebbs and flows of undocumented migration across the border very much coincide with the ebbs and flows of the economy. And because our economy is currently suffering, the undocumented migration levels are decreasing. So I certainly appreciate the fact that the Obama administration needs to point to successes in immigration enforcement to encourage a broader vision of reform that would really fix the broken immigration system. I think that it would be best to focus on the problems with the current immigration system, because it will never be possible to completely get undocumented migration under control, so to speak, until the system itself is fixed, because so much of the undocumented migration flow is a result of the broken system that, for example, requires close family members to wait for 15 years before they are able to obtain a migrant visa to come to the United States. So rather than focusing on enforcement first, the best approach really would be to look at what's broken in the system that's actually causing undocumented migration and start there.
Well, let's talk about that. As co-director of the Immigration Clinic at the University of Texas Law School, you see the real face of immigration every day. What would you like to see changed if you could write the laws?
Right. Well, there certainly needs to be something done about the 11 million or so undocumented immigrants currently living in the United States, who are living in the shadows, who are being exploited by employers, who are afraid to call police when crime takes place, for example, and so therefore are not only likely to be vulnerable to crime, but are likely not to report crimes that they see, impeding the work of law enforcement and so forth. A regularization program that allows migrants to come forward out of the shadows, to register, and to get on a path to permanent residency and citizenship is really what will need to happen. I would also like to see, as I mentioned, the family immigration system is largely broken as well. I would like to see additional numbers of visas assigned to allow family members, close family members, to migrate to the United States, because currently there are such significant caps, such limited numbers on the amount of people who can come through close family relations that you have this backlog of often literally 15 to 20 years before somebody can come on a migrant visa. So those categories need to be expanded. And perhaps most importantly, or at least as a very first crucial step that would show good faith and true movement in terms of immigration reform, we absolutely have to take care of the situation of the young students who have lived here their entire lives, who are very much a part of the education system and of the culture of the United States, but who are undocumented because they came with their parents when they were young and never were able to obtain proper immigration status in the United States. We've got to figure out a way to tap into the potential of those young people to contribute to our society by regularizing their status.
And how politically viable do you think ideas like those are right now?
I think it's extremely difficult because I think that the immigration enforcement only rhetoric has become sort of all encompassing. It's the point of departure for almost every conversation. As you just mentioned, that's where President Obama departed from in his recent immigration policy speech, and it's what Congress is demanding. However, as President Obama indicated, the problem with that is that if we focus only on immigration enforcement, we're not dealing with the real problems that lead to the undocumented migration, and it's very likely that those in Congress who have insisted on the enforcement only policies will, as Obama said, sort of continue to kind of move the threshold forward. So whenever there is an increase in the number of deportations, then the bar will be something different and higher the next time. Whenever there's an increase in construction of fence mileage, the bar will move forward the next time. So I do think it's very difficult without really sort of transforming the discussion away from this enforcement as a first step, rather than recognizing that enforcement will be more effective if the underlying problems of limited immigration, legal immigration, are not resolved, and if the regularization of the current population is not resolved. I would certainly hope that the DREAM Act, which is the legislation that has been proposed for quite a few years now to regularize the status of young people, is politically feasible, that it could be passed, but it will require that there be some real compromises and some real discussion of the issues.
Just to put a face on this in the last couple of minutes of this hour, could you tell us about some of the people you see in just a couple couple short snapshots of their stories?
We serve migrants from all over the world in situations of all kinds. We recently have been involved in the case of a young woman who would have qualified for the DREAM Act, who has been here since she was a very small child, came on a visa, as was described by the previous speaker, but her family overstayed. She's been here. She attended the University of Texas, did extremely well in her educational career, but she, University of Texas at San Antonio, but she is not able to obtain work authorization or any other way of regularizing her status because of the way she arrived here in the United States. This young woman was here at South by Southwest, a well-known national conference, and through an encounter with the police, where the police asked her to engage in some crowd control to move away, and she asked the officer why. This officer asked this client of ours for her identification, discovered she was undocumented. This young woman, who's an excellent student and young person, was sent immediately to the police station where her fingerprints were taken, and under the Secure Communities Program, that data was passed over to ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. She was picked up and detained by ICE for several days and put into deportation proceedings, even though this is the only country she has ever really known. We were able, through extensive advocacy, to get her a very sort of limited, what's called deferred action status, so that she can remain here, but she still is not on the path to permanent residence or citizenship because of her characteristics. We also serve...
Well, thank you for sharing that story. We're out of time, but I'm glad you left us with that. And Denise, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Denise Gilman, clinical professor of law and co-director of the Immigration Clinic at the UTexas School of Law. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening.